I'm Vermont Edition co-host Bob Kinzel. Just wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. House Republican leaders in Washington have unveiled a new tax plan that makes significant changes that will affect both corporations and individuals. House Speaker Paul Ryan says the plan will cost $1.5 trillion and is designed to benefit middle-class taxpayers.
This plan is for the middle-class families in this country who deserve a break. It is for the families who are out there living paycheck to paycheck who just keep getting squeezed. With this plan, we are getting rid of loopholes for special interests, and we are leveling the playing field. We're making things so simple that you can do your taxes on a form the size of a postcard.
How would this plan affect the majority of people in Vermont, and who would be the winners and who would be the losers if this plan passes? These are some of the questions we have for our guest today, Representative Peter Welch. Congressman, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Oh, thank you, Bob.
Great to have you on. Congressman, let's start with this tax bill, understanding there are some differences between the House and the Senate. But looking at the House plan, it reduces the corporate rate from 35% to 20%. It doubles the size of the standard deduction for individuals and families. It reduces the number of brackets from 7 to 4. It eliminates the deduction for local and state taxes, and it repeals the estate tax in 6 years. Now, the cost of the bill is roughly $1.5 trillion. Backers of the plan say it will be paid for by strong economic growth. On balance, do you think this plan will benefit most people in Vermont?
I don't. You know, that clip from Speaker Ryan, I'd vote for a tax bill that accomplished what he said, the focus on the middle class and getting rid of special interest. But now that the details are out of the bill, one of the special interests he's talking about is any homeowner who's paying mortgage and is paying a mortgage, and they will lose their mortgage interest deduction. It's any homeowner in Vermont who's paying property taxes, and they'll be limited in the House bill to $10,000, and in the Senate bill they'd lose that deduction entirely. It would mean the so-called special interest are a lot of these private activity bonds that we use for rebuilding housing and historic preservation in our downtown communities. It would also mean that students and parents who are paying student loans, the interest would no longer be deductible. It means that teachers who sometimes are reaching into their own pocket to pay for school supplies would not be able to deduct that, but corporations would. So the special interests seem to be the people in the middle class that he's identifying as a special interest, when in fact they should be the beneficiaries of the lion's share of any kind of tax cut. So no, I think they've really failed in this. And let me just add something. There's a process question here, and a lot of times that's boring for folks. But when you have no process, this bill was written in secret. Even the members of the Ways and Means Committee on the Republican side didn't know what was in it until it was finally unveiled. There hasn't been a single hearing on it. There have been no witnesses on it. And it's exactly the same process that was used when they were trying to repeal health care. It was written in secret. No hearings. So it means that there's no opportunity for real input in adjustment. So they failed on process, and what they now have is a bill that largely benefits corporations. It has a much bigger benefit for high income. To the extent there are some benefits in the bill for the middle class with increasing the standard deduction, many of those benefits expire after 5 years. And the cost of this is going to be paid for by our kids and our grandkids. And that's an aspect of this, the fiscal irresponsibility, that is very disturbing. Why would we put the bill for a current tax cut for corporations on our kids and our grandkids? So I think there's a lot of work to be done in this bill if we want to make something that's going to help the middle class.
So Speaker Ryan says the average family of four will save at least $1,000 a year in taxes under this legislation. And I think he's pointing to people who don't itemize. Most of the things that you were just talking about are people who itemize medical deductions, property taxes, local and state taxes. And I could be wrong, but I think a majority of Vermonters do not itemize on their income taxes. And if that's the case, could they benefit?
Some could. Some people will benefit very, very marginally. Others will lose. And as the years go by, about 5 years out, many of these benefits will expire altogether. So there is a modest benefit for some folks in low income and middle class. But 80% of the benefit – okay, we're borrowing $1.5 trillion. And 80% of the benefit is going to 1% of the people. So the structure of this is designed to put more money in the pockets of folks who have plenty of money in their pockets right now. And the remaining 20% is being shared essentially by 20% of the taxpayers. So yes, there's some benefit, but it really feels to me like it's a bait and switch because it should be the other way around. 80% should be going to 80% of the taxpayers, not to the top 1%.
Let's talk about the estate tax. People who want to repeal the estate tax say, you know, it amounts to double taxation. First, a person is taxed on their income. Then this money gets taxed again when they die. If that's the case, why should there be an estate tax at all?
Well, let's take the example of Donald Trump. All right, he has an immense amount of real estate. Apparently, he claims to be a multi-billionaire. The one time when we have his tax return, he barely paid any tax on a huge income. But bottom line here is he has assets that have appreciated in value. So let's say he's got real estate went from $500 million to $1 billion. Well, when he dies, his heirs take that without any tax on the gain. So they have what's called a stepped-up basis, and they take it – his daughters and sons take it as though they paid $1 billion for it. So in fact, it's misleading to say that they've already paid taxes on it. He may have paid taxes on his income, whatever interest income he's earned through corporate dividends or whatever capital gains he may have declared. But when he dies, whatever the value of Trump Tower is goes to his heirs at the then value, and those heirs are able to avoid paying taxes on any of that capital gain. So it's a pretty bogus argument, I think, on the part of really 0.1% of the American people who are in that category of having over $11 million in assets at the time of their death.
We got this email from Susan in Rutland who wrote us, in the last few days, I have heard incredible reports on how the wealthy are getting away with not paying their fair share of taxes. The report on the Paradise Papers listed individuals and corporations stashing their profits in offshore banks to hide their true wealth. Now the GOP tax plan will reduce the percentage of corporate earnings paid to the IRS while increasing the national debt to make up the deficit for government spending. This makes absolutely no sense at all, says Susan. Why must the middle and lower classes pay with their tax dollars when there are more than enough earnings going untaxed?
Well, you know, I think she's nailed it because you don't have to raise taxes if you just collect taxes from people who owe it and are finding clever ways to evade it. And I think when you look at the Paradise Papers and it shows how there's a very systemic effort to basically shield income that should be taxed from taxation in its dubious legal strategies, we in tax reform should be going after that before we ask anybody, including wealthy people, to pay more in taxes. Make sure everybody who has an obligation pays their fair share. You know, one of the things that Donald Trump in his campaign spoke against, and I agreed with him on this, was the so-called carried interest provision. And that's where the hedge fund folks on Wall Street are able to pay on income at the capital gain rate. Instead of paying at 38% or 39%, they pay at like 25%. And he said that was unfair and it was wrong and he was going to end it. He's backed down on that. But that's the type of thing that we should be doing if we're going to get reform. And we should start there. We don't have that in these tax bills as I've seen them in the House and the Senate.
Let's go to our callers and start with Colin, who is calling from Bristol. Hey, Colin, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. Great discussion. And thank you, Peter, for articulating so well, kind of like a different perspective on it. My question is this. It seems as if Paul Ryan is stating, you know, you need to give those tax breaks to the businesses so that, quote, they could see a growth in the economy. So I understand his perspective, but I really like the way that you unpack that, that that's not really the way you want to approach it. So if we can't give that 80% to the bigger businesses, how should we structure this package so that the middle class isn't really paying for it?
Well, there's really two things here, okay? There's the individual income tax and then there's the corporate tax. And the issues are somewhat different. The individual income tax, to the extent we're going to have benefits, I strongly believe both for fairness reasons and for economic growth reasons, it should be targeted on the middle class. If a family who's making $50,000, another family with two workers, and let's say they're making $100,000 in Vermont, which is good money, they have kids in college, they have a mortgage, they have high property taxes, they're the folks who need some relief. And if they get the relief, they're going to put that money back into the economy. They might be able to afford a vacation or they might be able to buy their son or daughter an extra pair of skates. But that money will get recirculated and that spending is going to boost the local economy. Wealthy people who have enormous amounts of disposable income have lots of options that include saving or just buying more stock or more bonds, but it's not getting recirculated. So the focus, both from a fairness issue and from an economic growth issue, I think should be on the middle class. Corporations, this is an area where had there been an open process, I actually think we could have come up with corporate tax reform, which we absolutely need. We've got a kind of chaotic system where we have a top rate of 35%, which is way too high. We're not competitive. But some corporations pay at 35. Other corporations pay at 1 or 2%. And wouldn't reform make sense where you lowered the rate, but you did that in part by having the corporations that are able to use loopholes to avoid their fair share pay at a rate that applies pretty much to all corporations? And there was no effort on the part of the Speaker Ryan to draft a bill that way. But Democrats, me very much among them, would want to sit down and simplify our corporate tax system to try to make us more competitive as well.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Mike, who is calling from Brantford, Connecticut. Hi, Mike. Welcome to the program.
Yeah. Good. Thanks for being here. Hey, If the illegal aliens are forced at least to control what the government is supposed to do, people that work in construction mainly, because I worked for 45 years in construction, they would see a big increase in the price of labor, which they would become the middle class, they would pay the extra tax, and they wouldn't mind. So the Democrats are right in a way. This is on the middle class. The growth, the growing area doesn't mind paying it. But we got to grow, make money. We'll work 80 hours, 70 hours, and you'll get your money. So nobody's describing it that way, but what's the big deal? If you make money, you pay taxes. So,
Well, that's right. But you're talking about construction trade workers who are incredibly hardworking. And if they get more work – and by the way, it's a reason why I am so in favor of a – at least $1 trillion infrastructure plan, we've got to put those folks to work. And those are good jobs. They pay good wages and they have good benefits. And our roads and bridges are falling apart. Rural America has to have a build out of high-speed broadband in order to be competitive. So we should be doing everything we can to reinvest in America and have a strong infrastructure plan. And again, this is a disappointment to me, quite frankly, because President Trump gets that. He spoke about it in the campaign. I was at a meeting in the White House with some Republicans and Democrats. He spoke about it again. But we don't have it. You know, they started with the effort to repeal health care. Now they're having a kind of upside down tax bill rollout, both in secret. There's enormous support in both parties to have a very aggressive and well-funded infrastructure plan that our country needs.
Congressman, do you think that there is a way to address this offshore money issue? Because even if you lower the rate from 35% down to 20, if you've got a bunch of corporations stashing their money offshore, then it really doesn't matter what the rate is, does it?
No, it doesn't. You're right about that. And again, another disappointment in this bill is originally there was going to be a tax. The first draft that the Ways and Means Committee put out was going to have a tax, a one-time tax on that offshore money. And that was the way they were going to pay for it. The corporations pushed back, and the Speaker Ryan caved in and gave up on that. But one of the plans for infrastructure funding is to provide an opportunity for companies to repatriate those earnings and pay a tax that's somewhat lower than what would be their normal corporate rate. So there'd be an incentive for the corporations to bring that money back, and that money could be used to help fund our infrastructure program. So that's a challenge that faces the country, and there's an opportunity here to take that problem and turn it into an opportunity that can help us with our infrastructure challenge.
So Republican leaders in the House and the Senate say they want to pass this tax bill by the end of the year. What's the outlook? What do you think? Is that realistic? Is it going to happen?
It could happen in the House, but not for a good reason, because they've had such radical changes that have been made not for policy reasons, but trying to chase a few extra votes so they can get to 218. And what I've been dispirited by in seeing some of my good Republican colleagues is they've given up on trying to have a good policy because they need a victory. You know, they're feeling a little bit pushed back on their heels because they failed to repeal health care. And now if this tax cut goes down, obviously that they see is really politically damaging. So there's a view that they'll vote for anything and just push it over to the Senate and hope for the best. But that is the hoping – who they're hoping for is their own reelection as opposed to the economy of the American people and the well-being of American taxpayers.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Our guest today, Representative Peter Welch. Congressman, we got this posting from Jeff on the VPR Facebook page, who wrote, "I recently lost power, including running water for 4 days. It made me keenly aware of the plight of our fellow citizens in the hurricane-ravaged Puerto Rico. The response of the U.S. government has been appalling. What can we do as a nation to help? Can we forgive their debt, change the rules that constrain the island's financial directions? Do you think that the United States has treated Puerto Rico differently?"
I do. They've not had the response in Puerto Rico from FEMA that Vermont had from FEMA after Tropical Storm Irene. The mayor of Puerto Rico, or of San Juan, was gave a very vivid and really depressing description of the extent of the suffering. And just think about what that writer said. Being without power for 4 days is really a significant problem. But if you're elderly, the roof has been blown off your home, and you're still sitting there weeks and weeks after the storm, and there's no help in sight, no power, that's literally hazardous to your survival. So I think our response there has been uncoordinated and slow. The one thing I will say, and the Republicans in Congress have stepped up on this, is that we've started to provide funding, which is obviously essential to get the relief to Puerto Rico. But the logistical response, I think, has not been good.
And why is that the case?
You know, I don't really know. Obviously, in a situation like this, you can have accusations fly, But, you know, my experience with FEMA here is that a lot of people really were working hard and dedicated to helping. In Puerto Rico, there was a slow response. I'm not certain that the president gave it the same level of attention as he did to Houston and to Florida. So I think that was a question. But I also think there's some really solid logistical challenges getting the supplies there, a little bit different than getting them to a continental scene of a disaster. And then the other issue, too, and this is a real problem, the infrastructure in Puerto Rico was very poor to begin with. They had a lot of problems with their electrical system and their power system. So it was very fragile. And the extent of the damage, I think, was quite stunning. Now, some of the practical things that could have been done better, when we have a storm here, GMP, Green Mountain Power, will get mutual aid from surrounding power companies in adjacent states. Puerto Rico could have done that, but they were, I think, I'm not quite exactly sure why they weren't allowed to do it, but that would have been a much faster way to respond because these power companies do send out their own people who know what they're doing. Instead, you heard about that $300 million contract that went to that company that had two employees, and that's obviously pretty bizarre, and we all want to get to the bottom of it. But how is a two-employee company going to be able to scale up to really restore power in the entire island? So there's a lot of questions about the competence, about the efficiency, about the contracting. And there are some logistical issues that particular to the island status of Puerto Rico, but also the very poor state of the infrastructure when that storm hit them.
Let's talk about health care for just a moment. There's a bipartisan effort in the Senate led by Senators Patty Murray and Lamar Alexander to strengthen the Affordable Care Act. That plan has also been endorsed by a bipartisan group in the House that you're a member of, No Labels. But it seems unlikely that this bill is going to be allowed to come to the floor of either the House or the Senate for a vote. Backers say they hope it might be added to a must-pass budget bill before the end of the year. Is that the most realistic strategy at this point? Do you think that'll work?
Well, it is the most realistic strategy. We met the problem solvers. We did meet with Senator Schumer, and we've had talks with Senator Alexander and Senator Collins. They wanted in a significant number of us in both the House and Senate want that concrete improvement of the Affordable Care Act. And what's significant about that, by the way, is that it was the first time that you had a number of us on the Democratic side who were supporters of the Affordable Care Act saying, you know what, there's some problems in the Affordable Care Act that need attention. And we found some Republicans, and on their side it's been tough for them to do anything other than repeal. They said, you know, there's some good things in the Affordable Care Act. You know, those insurance provisions, you don't lose your coverage if you're sick. You don't you can't be denied coverage. They like that. But there is a problem, and they agreed to work with us to stabilize the individual markets. And I saw that as the first very promising restoration of bipartisanship, which is essential to solve some of our major problems. The problem ultimately is that in the House, the only way a bill ultimately gets on the floor is if Speaker Ryan allows it to go on the floor. The Speaker has an enormous amount of power when it comes to controlling what the House will debate. If we put that bill on the floor, I think it would pass. I'm sure it would in the Senate. And in the Senate, what Mitch McConnell has said is that if President Trump gives him a signal that he'll sign the bill, he'll put the bill on the floor for a vote. So that's the challenge we have. The president has really chosen an approach on health care where after the failure of the repeal, they're trying to bleed it administratively, you know, holding back on payments for the cost-sharing reductions, not funding advertising for open enrollment, and other administrative steps that are really a part of an agenda to try to kneecap the Affordable Care Act, which is very regrettable in my mind. And in fact, you saw in the Virginia vote, you saw in the Maine vote, the people see health care as still a major issue that motivates their vote.
Let's turn to M, who's calling from Brattleboro. Hi, M. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you, and thank you for taking my call. And thank you, Congressman Welch. I want to ask you or point out that if we're going to make a huge investment in infrastructure, which is obviously needed, the problem is that will predominantly benefit the men in our society. And it seems to me that once again, the women are not being addressed for their lower earning capacity. And I think that, forgive me for saying so, but the patriarchy has never given a value to the nurturing that women do. So how could you balance out that that sort of investment in infrastructure with investment in the value of childcare, of teaching, or of perhaps even a minimum wage of $15 so that women aren't left out of the loop again?
Well, thank you. But you're right, of course, because women are paid about 70 cents on the dollar. And it's not like when a woman goes to the grocery store, they only pay 70 cents for what men pay a dollar for. So this pay imbalance really is there's no justification for it. So I get that. And many of the things that you're talking about that are so fundamentally important, childcare, education, health care, where we do have many tremendous women in those jobs, those jobs should be better paid than they are because the work involved in them is very, very important. But my view on this on something like infrastructure is that man, woman, black, white, whatever your sexual orientation, we all need good roads, we all need broadband, and we should all be in it together. And also I'm seeing more and more women want to get involved in the construction trades. So that might be an opportunity there. So when it comes to infrastructure, I think that that has to be something that benefits everybody in our society. But your point about women in the work they do and their entitlement to equal pay for equal work, I fully agree with. And thank you for your question and comment.
Let's talk to Randy in East Burke. Hey, Randy, what's on your mind today?
Hi. Thanks for letting me come on. It's hopefully be pretty quick. I just want to say respectfully, as an American citizen, I'm disgusted that we have these people in Washington who can get nothing done. And I know there's plenty of blame to go around for everybody, but I don't think that the people, the politicians, have heard what the voters said in this last election. We want change. What we've got here is gridlock. We've got infighting, outfighting, you name it. In my line of work, if as a department, for instance, if we did this, we'd be fired. I don't know how this continues, but I believe it's got to stop.
Okay, Randy, thanks very much for your phone call. Congressman Welch, what is it going to take to end this partisan gridlock in Washington that Randy's talking about?
Well, first of all, I want to thank Randy for that because he's speaking for a lot of Vermonters and frankly, he's speaking for me. The gridlock is terrible. And one of the things I hear from Vermonters more than anything else is, Peter, why don't you guys get together and get something done down there? So what are the challenges? I think there's a couple of things. All right. One, in the House, the way it's being run right now is that the Speaker Ryan won't put a bill on the floor unless they can pass it with 218 Republican votes. Now, what that means as a practical matter is that when it's a tough bill, he has to negotiate with the most extreme wing of his caucus in order to get to 218. What Speaker Boehner did a few times before he left is he said no to that 218 rule. And he came to us on the Democratic side, and we negotiated something that got significant Democratic support and actually significant Republican support because he would not let the extreme right wing of his party dictate what would be considered on the House floor. So in my view, if we had had an open process on health care, if we had an open process on taxes in particular, where Democrats were at the table from the beginning, there would have been much more of a likelihood we could have come to a compromise. And by the way, in that context where the Republicans are in the majority, it would be a compromise weighted to them, not to us. But Randy's got the right point, and it's why I would be willing to compromise and have compromised because I understand that it's really important to try to make that institution work. So that I think is really essential. The other thing, you know, the money in politics is really a problem. And members of Congress, one of the challenges we have is to try to make a connection and relationship with the people we represent. We do work for Randy. He and I may not agree on a lot of things, but my obligation is to listen to him and do the best I can to get things done. With the enormous money that comes in politics, there's a lot of incredibly negative advertising in every one of these congressional races and Senate races that has nothing to do with the relationship of that member with the people he or she represents. It has to do with some billionaire deciding this is a race that he thinks he can win, she thinks she can win, and they pour money into it, and people feel disconnected from the process. So this is dangerous. You know, what Randy said is it's an indicator of how people just get so fed up they lose faith in the political process. And that is going to hurt all of us. And, you know, it's why I hang in as hard as I can every day. I've got to do what I can to try to make that institution work.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Our guest today, Congressman Peter Welch. Let's turn to Rick in Burlington. Hey, Rick, welcome to the program.
Hi, Peter. I'm a little bit late saying thank you to this, but I did find out that you have joined the Climate Solutions Caucus, and I appreciate very much your doing that. I'm also curious what you have seen in the way of common ground with the Republicans that are in the caucus.
Well, there's a growing awareness among the Republicans that climate change is real, and more importantly, a growing awareness that politically, they're going to be real losers if they don't hop on board and try to be part of the solution. You know, one of my colleagues is from South Florida, and they're just having real challenges with sea level rise. So it's just indisputable and undeniable. The common ground has always been on energy efficiency, which actually can make a significant reduction in carbon emissions. If we want to reduce carbon emissions, about 40% of the goal would be achieved through energy efficiency. And it's the one area where I've consistently found pretty good cooperation from my Republican colleagues. They balk at spending any money to invest in it, but on other ways to approach it, they have been accommodating. So there is the beginning of a Republican membership group that I think is standing up and showing that they do want to get into addressing what is a very significant existential problem.
Do you think that an important part of the solution to climate change is the imposition of a national carbon tax?
I think it could work. It could be helpful. You know, what happens right now is that the social cost associated with our carbon fuel system are just spread out across the entire economy, and you have to pay in other ways. I mean, look at these storms that we've been having, the violent weather we've been having, Sandy, Katrina, the recent hurricanes that we've just had. That's all somewhat associated with climate change, and it's not at all reflected in the cost of carbon. So it's a major reason why so many economists, and by the way, leading former Republicans think that and even Rex Tillerson, who when he was at Exxon was in favor of having a price on carbon to reflect the true cost of carbon. I don't see us getting there with this Congress, but it makes economic sense to me. And if you designed it in the right way, you could make sure that it didn't hammer low and middle income families. But it would have to be designed in the right way.
I mean, how could you design it that way? Isn't it inevitable that it's going to add to the tax burden of low and middle income people?
Rebates are the ways that's the most specific way to do it. You raise a certain amount of money, you have a pretty realistic estimate of how much people drive, and that, you know, in a state like Vermont, it would be significant because we're so dependent on our automobile. And you'd have to make certain that you had a rebate that went to families that are part of the folks who were paying it.
Let's talk about North Korea. President Trump was in China this week, urging that country to impose tougher economic sanctions on North Korea. Is that the right approach?
Well, we need China's cooperation if we're going to try to get North Korea to the negotiating table. So I am okay and supportive, frankly, of the president trying to get China to be an actor that will help us make certain that North Korea doesn't have a nuclear weapon. And by the way, that's obviously in the interest of China as well as all those countries in the region, Japan, the Philippines, as well as South Korea. So, yes, I think the president should be putting pressure on China to be our ally in the effort to denuclearize North Korea. And by the way, the Iran deal that President Trump is so critical of, our ally in that, among others, it wasn't just the European nations. It was China and it was Russia. So this is one of the reasons why I don't think it's wise for President Trump to be so constantly critical of our allies, because even if we have some disagreements with them and some of our frenemies, let's say China and Russia, that there are times when it's in the interest of the United States to have their help to do something that increases our national security.
So if sanctions are not effective, and if North Korea continues to develop its program to build a missile capable of carrying a nuclear warhead that can reach the United States, does a military option have to be on the table?
Well, commanders always reserve the right to have a military option. But the military people who've looked at this say that the cost of a military option at a practical level is so extreme that it really raises feasibility questions. I mean, let's leave out the nuclear issue right now with North Korea, but they're moving – whether they could retaliate with a nuclear weapon at this time. They could retaliate with a massive conventional weapon strike. The border is only 27 miles from Seoul. And there's millions and millions of people there, about 230,000 Americans there, you know, 30,000 or so American troops there. And they all are within shooting distance, in effect, of a massive artillery response. So most of the military people think if there is any military plan or action that results in retaliation, then hundreds of thousands, if not over a million people, could be killed immediately. So that's a huge price. And the other thing that I've seen sometimes discussed is that the only way you could really be sure that North Korea didn't have a weapon would be a land invasion. And, you know, is that really going to be supported by the American people? Does it really make sense? We had a war in Korea, and it stalemated over 60 years ago. And, of course, we all remember Vietnam.
Let's turn to Ann, who's calling from Whitingham. Hi, Ann. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Whitingham is in Vermont. Anyway, first of all, I want to thank Peter Welch for writing me concerning my son, who struggled with opioid addiction. And I want to also commend Trooper Valcourt and Trooper Watakis of the Vermont State Police for really being compassionate. And my question is, are there any deep thoughts or really serious discussions around opioid treatment? Because what I see in Vermont, they're released on the street. The temptation is too great. We need to take them. That's what's helping my son. Take them away for a long time, away from the quote-unquote substances. And it's really hard to do that, and it's expensive. And I'm wondering if there are any really substantive discussions in Washington, D.C.
Well, two things. First of all, thank you so much for your letter that you were very open with me about the very, very serious situation that your family faced. And I think it's so important for people who have a family member or have an issue with substance abuse themselves, be open about it. I think that's what I really think Governor Shumlin, when he did an amazing thing by addressing by devoting his address at the State of the State address to the problem we had, it opened it up for discussion so that the community can get involved. Second, President Trump is declaring, forget the term, national emergency. And it reflects how everybody in this country is affected by the opioid crisis. It's not to Vermont. It's not just the Northeast. It's literally all over the country. So, yes, there's an enormous amount of interest and intention. There's a battle about money because I think the federal government's role is essentially to try to provide some financial backup for our communities, because the opioid issue, the front line, the hard work is all going to be done in our communities. The question you ask about having somebody be put away for a long time, you know, there was just an article that you may have seen in 7 days that talked about so many people in our prison system who have substance abuse problems and the challenge of treating them and getting them some of the medication that is used in trying to help people get away from their addiction. So these are challenges at the state level that have to be addressed. And there's a resource question for the state. There's a resource question for the federal government. But it is front and center on everyone's mind. At the end of the day, as you know better than anyone else, the real struggle is with the individual who somehow, some way, with help from family, with help from treatment programs, has to find that strength that's so important to be able to get away from it. So this is going to be with us for a while.
Congressman, we got this email from Keith in Post Mills. Military spending is 57% of discretionary spending. Will Congress cut that budget or continue to sacrifice our own people by cutting education and infrastructure to senseless wars that kill and destroy abroad and only breeds hate for America?
Well, I'm on your side on this one. I mean, we have a huge military budget, and the military budget, by the way, Congress messes that up in another way. Congress tends to micromanage the military, and I've had many military folks tell me that if we let them manage and we didn't micromanage, tell them where they could have a base or where they couldn't, or what thing they had to buy versus not, then they could do their job with a lot less money if they had managerial flexibility. But the big challenge for us budget-wise is to maintain that 50-50 agreement that had been made a few years ago, where for every dollar increase in domestic spending, or there'd be a dollar increase in military, or for every dollar in military, we'd boost up the domestic. We've got to do both. I mean, we've got to maintain investments in the domestic side, and our domestic spending is low now relative to its historic averages. We're spending on domestic needs about at the same level as we were during the Eisenhower presidency. So you've got a good point.
We're almost out of time, Congressman, could you give us an update on the legislation that would allow the federal government to negotiate drug prices for Medicare?
That's something that would have to be – if we're going to be successful, we'd have to try to get that into an end-of-the-year bill. There's a lot of resistance to it. A lot of my colleagues, Democratic side, tend to favor it. President Trump has told us, the American people, that he favors it. But this is, again, a situation where the majority, led by Speaker Ryan, it's up to him to put that bill on the floor. We get it on the floor, we pass it.
Do you think that might be part of the changes to the Affordable Care Act legislation?
You know, it's what should be, because we're looking for pay-fors. If you're going to maintain health care, you want to find ways to lower cost. And prescription drug prices that we pay are the highest in the world. So it's an obvious place where you can provide better care to people without having to raise taxes on people or premiums. Prescription drug prices are really they're really a ripoff. It's a longer conversation, but we're getting ripped off on those.
Well, the next few weeks will certainly be a very busy time in Washington, D.C. Congressman Peter Welch, many thanks for being on the program today.
Thank you very much, Bob.
That's our show for today. Next week on Vermont Edition, the rest of our congressional delegation. On Tuesday, we'll spend the full hour talking with Senator Patrick Leahy, and on Thursday, we'll speak with Senator Bernie Sanders. What questions do you have for Vermont's two senators and their busy schedule before the end of the year? Send your questions to vermontedition@vpr.net and listen next week. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Sengary and Matthew Smith. Jake Rusnak directed our program. We had production assistance from Gene Murphy. Sam Gale Rosen is the managing editor of Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Have a great weekend.